Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on
Community Radio.
Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We gather here around our kitchen table once a week to talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. And we come to you from the studios of KHOI Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames, Iowa. And we are glad you are with us around our table today. Well, there are signs of spring, Donna. Snow is melting and the days are getting longer.
Well, the days are getting longer. That's a certainty anyway at the moment. We don't know about the snow. It comes and goes, but the sun is doing what it's supposed to.
Very good. Very good. Also, I heard, to throw us for a loop again, I believe daylight savings time is showing up again in a week or two.
You know, there's been some rumblings and some scientific studies proving that it is actually not really good for us, and they're talking about finally ending this practice. Of course, it will take us years to get back to just, you know, letting the sun do its thing, but at least it's being questioned, the practice has been anyway.
Right. But they're working on that, and I would be glad to see it just kind of
go away.
Well, anyway, spring is coming anyway because things are kind of perking up.
Well, and the equinox is on the 21st or 22nd. I haven't looked, but it's coming up where the days are as long as the nights. Hallelujah.
Good. And people here in the Midwest are, I think, ready for a little bit of greenery. Well, thanks to hardworking local farmers, we can now enjoy fresh greens all year. It used to be not so unless you wanted to ship in your lettuce from California or other such long-away places. And now there are wonderful people that are taking on the task of keeping things going all year.
Local greens all winter long in Iowa.
So today we're going to talk about greens undercover. And no, I'm not referring to an environmental activist clandestine sort of thing. No, greens undercover, let's think about vegetables all year round. Today we have a special guest joining us around our kitchen table. Steve Strassheim from Twisted River Farm from Mitchell, Iowa. Welcome to our table, Steve.
Me, real pleasure to be here.
Good, good. Well, you have this wonderful farm called Twisted River. Has spring found you yet up there in northeast Iowa? Tell us about your farm.
No, it's north central Iowa,
north
right?
North central.
Yeah, we're just, about 2 hours north of you.
Oh, good. Well, has spring found you? And tell us about your farm.
Well, spring is, looking at the calendar or the forecast, I don't know if spring's it's trying, but it's going to be a little bit yet. But it's always spring in our tunnels, which we're here to talk about. Our farm, we are about a 3.5-acre mixed vegetable farm up here in Mitchell County. So if nobody's familiar where Mitchell's at, we're about 5 miles, a little bit north and west of Osage, and about 30 minutes north and east of Mason City. So that's where we're at, and we distribute all of our vegetables as far over as Clear Lake, Iowa, Mason City, Northwood, St. Ansgar, Charles City. That's kind of us.
Good, good. How did you get started?
I grew up on a sugar beet farm in eastern Montana, and I was that farm kid that just could not wait to get off the farm and go see the world. Well, I went and saw the world in Fargo, North Dakota, went to college there, and then a stiff wind blew me to Iowa about 2008 and with a prior career, and I, at that time, had no desire to be a farmer, kind of got into the business world, and farming kind of refound me about 2014 and kind of through of a weird series of little twists and turns and series of events that brought me to discover kind of local food. Local food wasn't something I was ever really, aware of. Farmers markets, direct to consumer, any of that kind of stuff was not on my
radar. You don't eat sugar beets, right?
Well, not
not usually, not directly, no. And so I got to be really fascinated by the local food system and the local food economy and just really dove in. And, you know, North Central Iowa at the time wasn't exactly a local food hotbed, so we kind of, we can't find a lot of what we want. We'll just start kind of growing what we want. And I just really fell in love with the production part of it. You know, even in a small little backyard garden, so I love getting my hands back in the dirt and kind of reconnecting to my youth a little bit, I guess, in a nostalgic kind of a way. But kind of found it just resonated. Started doing a farmer's market, you know, a year or two later. And from there, it's just been uphill or, you know, downhill, uphill, whichever way you want to say it.
So you're like a farming junkie here. We can't, say no.
Yep. That's right, yeah.
It's a healthy addiction.
Good, good. Well, the impact on local economies of local of small farms is often underrated, but keeping Iowa alive and well really depends on healthy soil and the farmers that take care of it. And you are doing that. Steve, tell us about your greenhouse experience. You have a small farm, but you've been doing lots of interesting things with greenhouses.
Yeah, so we got into covered production, or we call them hoop houses. There's some nuance there in some of the terminology. Some people kind of use greenhouse and hoop house and high tunnels somewhat interchangeably. Our tunnels do not have concrete floors in them. So what I think of a greenhouse, I think of when you go to like a nursery to buy starter plants and you're walking on concrete in there and they got the benches. To me, that's kind of a greenhouse. Our tunnels are set up with just dirt floor, so we plant right into the soil in covered tunnels, mainly so that we can control the climate. We can control the humidity, the temperature, the water, and it's at, you know, in Iowa where we get cold winters. We can add literally, I mean, in some cases year round, but for a lot of our crops, we can add 2 months on in the spring and 2 months on into the fall for a lot of our growing season. So it's a wonderful season extension tool for us and allows us to feed more people.
Good. Explain how these are things you can walk into. How high and how big are these tunnels?
They come in a variety of sizes. The four that we have two smaller ones, which we call caterpillar tunnels. At the peak, they're probably I'm 6'2". They're probably about 7.5 feet at the peak. They're kind of just an arch structure, about 14, 15 feet wide. So you can walk in there. You know, we run our soil working equipment in there, no problem. You can stand straight up even on the sides. So they're a little smaller, but they work really well for what we call the shoulder seasons. You can kind of start planting into those in mid-March or so around here. And, you know, you can harvest into December even in those. And then our bigger ones are, what are they, about 14 feet at the peak. They're a lot taller. They're about double the size, both width and height. And those hold the heat longer, and they stay warmer longer. So they just have more thermal mass, not to bore your listeners with all the science-y part of it. But they just hold the heat longer, so you can stretch that out a little bit further. So, you know, like I said, some of our crops, like spinach and kale, and some of our lettuces now, because of our geothermal system, we can grow all the way through the winter without any problem.
Oh, tell me about that. Because, you know, in terms of having a local food system for a population that is used to having, you know, greens all year round, we're not talking about just living off of the pantry foods, that the canning that you put by. In the middle of the winter, we've become quite accustomed to our leafy greens. So tell us how we can do this in Iowa.
So based on our experience with our first three tunnels, we were really pleased. We didn't put any heating system in there. If you do any little bit of research and looking around, and there's even quite a few growers in Iowa, they'll put those typical propane heaters up in there, and they'll, you know, burn propane to keep them a little bit warmer. And just from our kind of experience with talking to some other growers and our own experience growing some stuff like spinach and kale without even any heat, you know, they were looking okay all the way through the winter. You know, like even, you know, we get some minus 20 degree nights, you know, occasionally through the winters up here in North Iowa. And they would survive that, you know, with some row cover, you know, some frost protection in there, but they would do just fine. And through kind of a happenstance meeting with my partner in the geothermal project, Eric Jellum, he's a corn and soybean farmer that's about 7 miles south of my farm, and we were chatting, and he was really interested in about my tunnels, and he actually had put a geothermal corn drying system in on his farm, so he's able to dry a bin of corn using geothermal.
Never and heard of that.
Nope. I'm pretty sure it's the only one in the world. It's very experimental, and it works wonderfully. It takes longer, but you don't have to burn a drop of propane to dry a bin of corn. It's pretty uncanny. So he invited me down to look at that system, and we got to chatting more, and he said, well, there's no reason why this system wouldn't work in one of your tunnels. And so wow, that's a kind of an odd, you know, or an interesting idea. So we talked more and more, and we started sketching out what that might look like. And so we partnered together, and through a SARE grant through the USDA, we were able to build our fourth tunnel on his property. And tied it actually into his corn drying system. The tunnel has its own geothermal system, but it is tied into his bigger system. So on those really, really cold nights, we can throw a lever and take advantage of the ground heat that is used to dry his corn.
Go ahead. I want you to explain what the beauties of what geothermal is. And, I think it's the most fantastic thing, better than buttered bread, you know.
Not quite. But where does the heat come from?
How does this work?
It comes from the earth. So the earth, even in the wintertime, if you go down below our frost line, the earth is always at about a constant 52 degrees or so. And so basically what the principles of geothermal are is you bury, there's a lot of different iterations of geothermal. You can use, you know, liquid systems, air systems. There's a lot of different examples of air systems where they basically bury tubes underneath the ground down below that frost line to pick up that 50 some degree temperature, transfer it to the air, and then bring that air back up and use that, you know, quote-unquote warmed air to warm greenhouses. But we had never seen anybody use a liquid system where you basically bury, you know, a water pipe down there or, run antifreeze through it and use the heat of the earth to warm that antifreeze solution and then bring it up and then use that warmed solution to go through a couple heat exchangers, which look like basically truck radiators. And then we blow a fan across that to transfer the heat into the tunnel. So we just, our system could not be simpler. It's just a couple of tubes, a water pump, and a fan. It could not be simpler. Really inexpensive and extremely effective.
And
how
deep is the frost line? Sorry, I don't know these things.
In Iowa, it's, they say, you know, it's 6-7 feet usually. Our tubes, we buried before we built the structure over top of it. And they are down there about 6 to 8 feet. They kind of, if you imagine, like, we buried some geothermal, like, water lines underneath there vertically. So if you think of, like, a slinky that you stretch out and it kind of loops over top of itself, that's basically what we did in that tunnel. But we buried it about 8 feet, and we made 3 independent loops down there. So when you're walking in the ground, you know, in the tunnel, you don't see any of that. It's all below your feet. About, you know, the highest point of the tubes are about 2 to 3 feet below your feet. So you never see them. You know, we can run a tiller in there if we want to, and we'll never hit them. But they're down there, and they're just collecting that heat of the earth, and then we transfer it to air through those heat exchangers, as we call them. But again, they just look like a truck radiator. And we just blow air across those, and then we distribute that air. Just it blows out into the tunnel and keeps it, the performance of it. If you didn't have that system in there and you had, let's just say we'll use minus 20 degrees Fahrenheit nights, you know, really cold January night in Iowa without any kind of heat, you'd probably only see about minus 18 in that tunnel. It wouldn't be much warmer at night, maybe even minus 19. I mean, it's going to be really cold in there. With our system, we're able to keep it generally around 16 to 20 degrees above Fahrenheit. So about a 35 wow. to sometimes almost 40 degree spread with just the heat of the earth coming up. And it's really inexpensive to run that. We calculate it to be about $35 a month just with electricity costs. And if you were to use propane, you know, you're talking maybe $2,000 a month to achieve a very similar result. So it's really inexpensive.
Well, was the initial system expensive to put in?
No, that in the grant that we got through SARE helped cover a lot of that cost. And so the system itself was probably about $2,000. And some of it was just, you know, our fan was an old granary fan, you know, just a big three-blade, you know, nothing fancy, you know, old air-moving fan. You know, we bought the heat exchangers brand new. Those were a little expensive, and the geothermal piping down there is a little, probably one of the most expensive pieces, and all the bits and bobs to connect all the pipes and the manifolds and all that. But it couldn't be a simpler system. Eric designed it, and it's very, very simple. If anything breaks, we can run to the hardware store and fix it. We don't need anything, you know, real specialty to
And so the liquid that's circulating, it's just recycled, right? Use the same liquid over and over again?
It's just a closed loop system. So once that gets pumped through all the little, you know, twirlies underneath the ground, it comes back up to the heat exchangers, and then we just send it right back down, and it makes another loop, and it just keeps going round and around and around. Now, the beauty part of that system is that because of the tunnel, you know, it's clear plastic, the sun during the day, even in January, if you get a nice, you know, clear blue bird day, even with the low sun angle, that sun's going to recharge that heat that we're losing too. So you're pulling some of the heat out of the ground, but then the sun's going to recharge it for free. So we really pray for those nice sunny days in January so we can replenish some of the heat that we're taking out of the ground. We're in year two of the project, and we've just been ecstatic with the results.
Oh, that's great. I live in a solar heated house. We're kind of bermed in the side of a hill, and a lot of our heat comes from the sun too. And being very aware of that January sun when it comes through. And also, I have a small greenhouse that's actually in part of the house. I mean, it's in the basement and it's in the ground. And again, the sun coming in those windows makes a whole lot of difference. And with row cover, I've been able to do things even without, well, of course, we're talking geothermal as in the earth is helping to keep my little greenhouse warm, too. What sort of things do you grow in this geothermal greenhouse?
In the dead of winter.
In the dead of winter.
Yeah. So we've experimented a little bit. Keeping in mind that we are a business, and so we want to make sure we have marketable product that we can actually sell. We're definitely interested in the science of how far we can push certain crops, but at the same time, we want to make sure we can sell what we're growing. So we've really concentrated on leafy greens. You know, I always talk about spinach and kale being kind of the king and queen of winter growing. They don't seem to have a bottom temperature. So when I tell people, yeah, we kept our tunnel at 16 above, overnight with the geothermal system, they're like, well, 16, I mean, that's still freezing cold. That's really cold. Well, spinach and kale at 16 or so degrees, it's spring break for that. You know, it just doesn't even bother. We don't even cover it at 16. I've seen it take minus 15, and the next day the sun hits it, pops right back up. So, I mean, they're very, very, very cold.
So it doesn't kill them.
Oh, it does my heart.
It does not kill them.
Good.
Yeah, they look, without any kind of protection, they look kind of
sad
the next morning, but as soon as the sun hits it, they pop right back up and they look just fantastic. Now, lettuces, on the other hand, are a little bit more temperamental. Some lettuces, you know, 25, 26 degrees and they're pretty much gone. We've selected for the lettuce varieties, some of the header lettuces that they've been breeding. You know, they'll take 20 down to 15, you know, no problem. So, you know, if we can kind of keep it to 16 or 20, the lettuces look fine. Generally speaking, those lettuces, they'll survive down to 10 or 12, but they look pretty, they don't bounce back like the spinach or kale does down below about 15 or so, you get a lot of leaf quality damage, thus affecting the marketability of it. So it's a little bit of, you know, hedging the bet against the cold with the geothermal system, but also variety selection and, you know, cold mitigation with, you know, some of the frost protection blankets that we have. Even in the geothermal tunnel, like back in late January up here, we got that minus 20, you know, couple nights there. We put the frost blankets on in the, even in the geothermal tunnel on the lettuce just to make sure, you know, like.
Good for you.
Just to make sure.
But okay, describe what a frost blanket is.
Yeah, what's a frost blanket?
Frost blanket, it's just a simple, any, you know, you can get it at the hardware store even. It's just like a white, geotextile type of a, blanket, literally a blanket, like a thin blanket. Some of them are heavier than others. We get the 30 ounce weight, so they're kind of heavy. They're good. Generally one layer, they say, gives you about 5 extra degrees. So even outside, you'll see, like, in, if you ever look at pictures, you know, drive over in vegetable production areas, sometimes you look out in the fields and you see these big white blankets draped over the fields in perfect rows. Those are frost blankets.
Yeah, and they're, and as and, I understand it, they are designed to, so that light will go through it. Not 100% of the sunlight,
yes,
but
yep,
but the plant.
No, it definitely, yeah, it definitely filters it. Yeah, yeah, but it diffuses it some, but definitely lets some light in and gives you that few degrees of frost protection.
Well, so at those temperatures, are you actually getting growth, or the plants are just merely surviving?
More of the latter. So in our latitude, and let me back up just a quick second. Plants need, generally speaking, about 10 full hours of sunlight per day at the minimum for what they say vigorous growth or even minimal growth. We cross under 10 hours of daylight in North Iowa or even most of Iowa at or around November 3rd, and we don't get those 10 hours back until about the first week of February. So from November 3rd to February 3rd, I call the lights go out, and we go under, and, you know, we're down at about 8.5 to 9 hours of daylight. So the plants don't really grow. They grow a little bit, but basically we're using those tunnels as giant walk-in coolers and harvesting those crops when we want them. So our strategy with winter growing is to get the plants up to about 80% maturity by, you know, the first part of November when the lights go out, and then we hold them in the into the deeper parts of winter at almost stasis, and we can harvest off of them as we need to. And they do grow a little tiny bit on those really nice warm days. You can, you know, they do grow some, but, you know, in the summer, for comparison, if you cut greens, you know, they'll grow back. In the summer, it might be 6 to 8 days regrowth. In the wintertime, if you cut it at November 10th, it might take till January 20th to grow back. I mean, it's a very, very slow amount of growth that it puts on in the winter.
But these things, they are growing and they are alive, and it sounds like you've got a really...
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, really tell me what your dead of winter mix contains. What's it look like?
So we basically concentrate on just those three products. We have, like, we call our spring mix, which is just baby lettuces. You know, we have mostly greens and red lettuce in there. Then our baby spinach, which we sell separately, and then our kale, which we grow out in bunches. So we just basically have those three main crops that we grow in the tunnels.
So it's not baby kale then.
No, we don't. We tried some of those. Didn't really see much of a market for it up here. So, but large bunch kale we do. So we do sell a lot of bunch big kale.
Sounds good. We'll come back and talk more with Steve. I want to take this opportunity to say this is KHOI Community Radio. You're listening to the Don Alanna Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. the Donalana Kitchen. We're talking about greens undercover.
All year round in Iowa.
Growing good things to eat, even in those cold winter days. We're talking to Steve Strassheim from Twisted River Farm. Steve, how did you get the name Twisted River Farm?
Good question. We lived in Nora Springs, Iowa, which is just about 20 minutes down the road here, and we lived on a very twisty little turny banks of the Shell Rock River. So our place that we were living at the time was right on the banks, and so thus Twisted River Farm came to be. We moved here to Mitchell about 5 years ago, and we're a stone's throw from the Cedar River, even though we're not up butted up against it, but we kept the name all the same because everybody knew it by then. So
good. Twisted River is very, very good. I want to talk about the challenges of greenhousing. What little bit I've done, I often thought, as I take care of things, it's really hard to play God. I tell you, take care of everything in there. When you close something up, you realize you are responsible for the light, the heat, the pest management, the water, and you have to be quite timely. Talk about the challenges you face putting up a greenhouse.
Yeah, all those things that you mentioned can be a challenge to manage. You know, in the wintertime, the management is a lot different than the management of the summertime. In the wintertime, we're worried about mostly heat, and we're really worried about humidity. There's a lot of humidity that can be gathered in the wintertime, and that can create some fungal problems. So those two are kind of challenges for us in the wintertime. In the summer, it's keeping them cool, keeping them ventilated. It gets really, really hot in there. And so keeping it cool, keeping a lot of air through there, because there again, in our muggy summers of Iowa, even more humidity moves in there. So we got to keep the air moving just so we don't have some of those issues. But beyond that, you know, we can automate a lot of the watering, and you know, fertility comes in through that in some cases. So those aren't really big challenges for us, but as we experienced with our geothermal tunnel in December of 2021, and we had that wintertime derecho that came through, and we lost some plastic on that tunnel, it's not always that the wind is blowing, it is what the wind is blowing. We had a piece of metal blow off of a machine shed and cartwheel into the tunnel and slice it in two like a hot knife through butter. So those are big challenges. Anytime the wind picks up, are about the only sleepless nights I usually have. So.
Oh, very good. Very good. You talk about growing in soil in these tunnels. How do you keep up soil fertility? Do you move the tunnels, or what do you do for the soil?
So we bring in a lot of compost. We have a local source of compost that we bring in to add some natural fertility to it. Depending on the crop, we do add in even more fertility. Like cucumbers are a pretty heavy feeder, so we're feeding those through drip line. Tomatoes, we used to do that too, but we're kind of switching to more of a front-loaded fertility program where we do soil amendments even in addition to the compost to kind of get us through the season with our tomatoes. Ask me how that turns out end of this year, but we're going to give it a shot this year. And then, you know, one of the issues that growers can experience with soil growing with tunnels is when you add in some of those amendments, a lot of those are salt-based. And so a lot of times you'll hear, if you do start getting into greenhouse production, your soil can become very salty after some years. And so a lot of times what people do when it's time to replace the plastic on the greenhouses, which is about every 6 to 10 years, kind of depending, is they'll leave the plastic off ahead of a rain and let the rain flush out the soils. And so that's kind of a management trick to kind of keeping the soil healthy. But other than that, we soil test twice a year in the tunnels just so we can kind of see what's happening in there from the spring to the fall and add amendments or not as needed based on our soil tests.
Very good. Are things direct seeded in your greenhouse, or do you put out seedlings, and do you grow your own seedlings?
We mostly transplant seedlings in there. Just there again, tunnel space is an expensive premium, and you want to make sure you get a good crop. And so we can control that with seedlings. You know, if you put a seed in the ground in there, you know, it's a wait and see kind of a guess as whether or not you're actually going to get a crop to grow. With seedlings, we can grow those, you know, start them in another tunnel and control and select. You know, we can start a tray of 150 seedlings, and maybe we only need 125. And so we know that we've hedged our bet that the seeds are going to germinate, and we can also select the ones that we like that are showing a lot of vigor and promise. So we do a little bit of direct seeding. Like we do some carrots and radishes in our tunnels. Those are about the only things we direct sow in there anymore. Those are pretty, I wouldn't say they're 100% guaranteed, but pretty fail safe. We usually have pretty good results with direct seeding those two crops. But everything else gets a transplant.
Great. You mentioned selecting seeds that, especially for lettuces, that work in greenhouses for the cold winter months. I notice as I flip through my seed catalogs, there are all kinds of varieties, tomatoes especially, and cucumbers, that are specially made for greenhouses. What's the difference between a greenhouse-grown plant and one that would be out in the field?
Usually with those seeds in particular, when you're talking about tomatoes and cucumbers, generally speaking, it's that they can handle that excess heat and humidity that you would see in a tunnel situation. A lot of times tomatoes and especially cucumbers are really susceptible to leaf fungal and bacterial issues. And so when they are breeding those different plants, they'll breed in the ability to set fruit at higher temperatures, which, you know, tomatoes are kind of known to be heat loving, but they also start aborting their flowers at 90, kind of depends on the variety, but they say around 93 to 95 degrees. So they kind of breed in and select for those traits that will allow them to withstand those higher temperatures and those sometimes higher humidity environments.
Well, now, in the summer, does your geothermal tunnel, can you use the geothermal to keep those extreme heats down, like an air conditioner?
You could, theoretically, and we discussed that when we were designing the system, and really what it would entail is just reversing the flow and sinking the heat, kind of reversing the water direction and bringing the heat from the tunnel back into the ground versus the other way around. The issue that we ran into our particular situation is the condensation. Essentially, that acts like that would be like a huge swamp cooler.
Oh.
And we'd have to figure out some way to catch that condensation and store it and somewhere to do with it. And it's not out of the question. We might look at doing something like that. We'd need a bigger fan, which poses some logistical issues in our particular size of tunnel, and there's some ventilation issues. But it definitely could be used for that.
I like your approach to different changes and different things you can invent. I think the best part of being a farmer is saying, well, we can do that, and you get your neighbor in, and you start tinkering. And
it's creative.
It is. It's a creative thing. It is. I want to go back to tomatoes and cucumbers in a greenhouse. I've never grown tomatoes and cucumbers in a greenhouse. Are these caged or trellised to get up off the ground, or how do you deal with them in the greenhouse?
Yes, we trellis them on a single, we call them leaders, but they're just a string. We've got some wires that we've ran the length of the tunnels over top of where the beds would line up, and then we just attach some strings along and drop it down, secure it to the soil, and then we just train the tomatoes and the cucumbers, and they'll climb right up those strings. We do that for a couple of different reasons, but mainly ease of harvesting. We like not having to bend over so much to harvest everything. So it really makes it easy. It does cut down on a lot of, especially with cucumbers, you know, if everybody's growing them out in the garden and, you know, by the end of the season and they get the soil splash up on the leaves and they get, you know, some of those late season blights, especially on tomatoes, we can control that having them up off the ground inside of the tunnels so we can have a longer production without having to deal with a lot of the blights and, you know, some of those other fungal issues that might see on, so you know, flat ground type production.
Good. You grow those things in the tunnels and greenhouses and hoop houses. Do you grow other things outside?
Yeah, we have about 3.5 acres of outdoor uncovered production that we do throughout the season. We have just starting all those seeds here in the last couple of weeks, and we've got a full planting schedule here for the next month or so, and we'll start seeds all the way until July for an August planting. So we're pretty much seed starters now until about July.
Very good.
I should say actually in August. So yeah, we start a lot of seeds, and right now is the busiest time. So we're seeding a lot of different stuff. And we grow, we're a full, kind of full service vegetable. We grow, I always say A to Z except for sweet corn and potatoes. We don't grow those two crops, but just about everything else we can grow in Iowa, we grow in between.
Well, that's good. That's good. Do you have any advice for some of our listeners, maybe home gardeners? So if you have advice for anybody who wants to start a seed this time of year or start a small garden, what just a short word of advice or encouragement to a little backyard gardeners here?
Yeah, well, I'll say there's always no wrong way to do things. You know, sometimes you get kind of hung up on what size of tray should I use and what kind of dirt and starting mix and all that. You know, really, the seeds want to grow. We kind of just have to put them in the soil and get out of their way. So I kind of advise, you know, people not to get hung up on some of the smaller details too much. But the biggest piece of advice that I always give people for starting their seeds is when you put your, you know, if you got some supplemental lighting that you're, you know, if you have like a rack or a table or a light or something, get that light as close to those seeds, I mean, almost touching that dirt. You think those lights are bright, but honestly, they're not even a fraction of how bright the sun is and the power that it has. And a lot of times people struggle with leggy seedlings, even with what they think is bright light. You get those lights close, and what often helps is to have the lights on a chain or some kind of a rope or system where you can raise it up. So as the plants grow and they almost start touching the light, raise the light up a couple more inches and then kind of stair step it that way. You'll have way better quality of starts.
Great. That is great advice. Because I've been growing seedlings for years, and it's a miracle however you want to talk about it, but they can use your help, and that's some good advice, Steve. I'm going to take another little break here and remind people that you're listening to KHOI, and this is Donna Lana Kitchen. You can find out more about this station and more about the Donna Lana Kitchen at www.khoifm.org. Welcome back. We're talking to Steve Strassheim about his work in learning to stretch the growing season. He's got a lot of greenhouse, a lot of plants under cover.
And Twisted River Farm. Love that name.
Twisted River Farm. He keeps crops alive and well throughout the winter. Let's talk about more about fresh local greens and veggies all year round. Let's talk about marketing.
Yeah, you grow it, and then what do?
You got to sell it.
That's right. Can't eat it all.
We've really kind of carved out a pretty diverse marketing couple channels for ourselves. North Iowa has a lot of opportunity for vegetable production since there's not a lot of us up here. So we service 5 area grocery stores, and we have our product in those. We're in about 4 or 5, kind of depending on the season, restaurants. And we do 2 farmers markets, the Mason City Farmers Market and the Clear Lake Farmers Market. And then we started a home delivery program in light of COVID a couple years ago, and that has continued to be very popular. So we do a home delivery program. And through that, then we started an actual CSA. We never really wanted to thought we would do a CSA-type marketing model, but we have a 65-member CSA that we home deliver as well.
That's great, and I assume you have help. You don't do this all by yourself.
No, not at all. We have 4, soon to be 5 seasonal part-time employees. They are wonderful, and we could not do this without them.
Good, and still, all this stuff we were talking before the show, you're getting into flowers. Tell us why flowers.
Yeah, so there again, it was kind of the market was wide open for cut flowers. I mean, I'm sure people down in your area have seen, you know, flower bouquets at the farmers markets and other outlets for probably a number of years. It's never been a big crop up here. And so there's a few of us doing it, but we decided to add it into our rotation last year, and we had really good success, very good feedback, and we are increasing that substantially this year. So now flower farmers.
Are you growing, are they all annual flowers, or do you have established beds? What are you doing?
Mostly annuals. My wife she doesn't work in the business day to day. She's got a day job in town, but she kind of heads up our flower selection process because that's not my forte. But we have mostly annuals. She's got some perennial stuff that she started just for her own, you know, enjoyment years ago that we've incorporated into some of the bouquets too. So we do have a little bit of perennial, but mostly we've concentrated on the annuals.
Good. You mentioned farmers markets and the potential for more people to be involved up there in your part of the state. Do you have advice for veggie farmers that want to get into this?
Start. We need more vegetable growers. We're especially in North Iowa. We used to have a stronger community, but you know, through old age and retirement, and unfortunately, some have passed on in recent years. There's not many of us anymore, so we definitely would like to see a younger generation come up behind us now. I'm only 43, so I'm not exactly an old guy, but I'm not a young pup anymore. But there's not really too many people. There's not really anybody coming up behind me now, so we need more veggie growers. But I do always, when I talk to other farmers and whatever in general, you know, the advice kind of rings true. Start small, you know, get to know a few of your crops really, really well. It's easy to get really pie-eyed and think you're going to change the world off, you know, in your first year, but start small. You know, that old saying, find your people, find your tribe, find your customers, find people that are going to buy that truckload of lettuce from you, and develop that customer market. And from there, seeds kind of want to grow, so you just got to get out of their way.
I think it's wonderful that you're in a business, especially at your age, which is not that old, where you can encourage your competition.
It might sound counterintuitive to say that, but I have a real interest in just seeing the local food economy in North Iowa in general flourish. And we've got a lot of meat producers that have come on in the last number of years, you know, doing direct-to-sell protein in one version or another, but we just have not seen, you know, vegetable production. And it's hard. It takes some land, which is, you know, land access in Iowa is a big issue for not just vegetable farmers, but, you know, farmers in general, for especially new or younger farmers, land access can be an issue. So, yeah, there's a lot of challenges in getting started, but I think our farm has been a little bit of a model on what you can do without, you know, own land. We only own an acre out of the 3.5 that we farm, so you can do it without owning land and create relationships with your neighbors and start small and just let the market drag you into getting bigger.
Well, yeah, land. And you can get a lot of produce out of a small acreage, which is not true with livestock and things like that. So
very, very true, yeah. We actually kind of started our farm based on, like, an urban-type farm model, even though we're in a rural area. You know, small plot, small footprint, quick-growing, high-value-type production. When we first started, you know, when I say kind of my first year doing this full-time about 5 or 6 years ago, I was just farming on a quarter acre. That's not much. That's a backyard. I mean, we literally tore up our backyard, and that's how I started. But you'd be surprised, you know, how much product you can get out of, you know, a small space like that. And then we have microgreen production indoors here, too. So we you're able to complement from a revenue perspective. And, yeah, you can make a living off of a small space.
So are you
control your costs?
You're doing the microgreens all year round then?
Yes. Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, if I turn my camera just 180 degrees, you'd see 6 vertical racks with LED lighting full of microgreens.
Good.
And grow those indoors here, and those have, you know, this room I'm sitting in is just heated with an electric space heater, essentially. In the wintertime, and my office is here, and then 6 feet over, it's microgreen production. So you can do it in weird spaces that you wouldn't be able to really think of growing anything else. But if you can put a couple racks, utility racks in that you can get at Walmart or on Amazon, put a couple lights on it.
And that gives you another product for your distribution, which you have to do anyway, right?
Very much so. Yeah, we have microgreens are kind of a, oh, geez, we could spend a whole show talking about microgreens, but we've kind of whittled it down to about 2 products mostly. We'll throw a third one in seasonally, but we grow pea shoots and a micro radish blend that we call a micro blend. And
nice.
We were
very
able
nice.
To find a market.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we're able to find a market for those 2 very widely through grocery stores, restaurants, and our direct, you know, farmers market and our home delivery program.
Well, good.
But you can grow microgreens. You can grow micro whatever, micro arugula, carrots, cilantro, basil. There's all sorts of different microgreens you can grow, but we've kind of just honed in on those couple from a ease of growing and a marketability standpoint.
Very good, very good. And speaking about getting started, you have a Practical Farmers of Iowa field day scheduled for sometime this summer. Do you have a date for that, Steve?
June 18th, and I think we're working with Jacqueline at Practical Farmers. I think it's 1 o'clock, if I'm not mistaken, but we have some details to work out on that. But it's June 18th, Sunday, June 18th for sure. It'll be at our farm here, so you can see kind of our main operation. And then we're going to all hop in our cars and drive down to see the geothermal tunnel.
Sounds like a good thing. So for more information on that, contact practicalfarmersofiowa.org and look up their field day list, which I'm sure is getting full by now.
Well, yeah, they haven't published it yet, but it'll probably be out soon.
Oh, very good. Oh, and also, before we go, Steve, what is your contact information? Do you have a website and all that sort of stuff so people can find you?
Oh, sure. Yep. TwistedRiverFarm.com is our website. If you Facebook, you can find Twisted River Farm. Instagram, we're on those 3 platforms often. We use those a lot. And if you want to reach out directly, you can email me at info@twistedriverfarm.com.
Great. It is inspirational to talk to you, and thank you for telling us about your greenhouses. It's an amazing way of using one's brain to grow more good stuff here
all year round.
Thank you for being with us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on.
Good.
Well, toodaloo, maybe we'll come see you this summer.
Yeah, we do field days. That's fun.
Yeah.
So we've been talking to Steve Strassheim from Twisted River Farm. We've been talking about greens.
Up in North Central Iowa.
Yes. Greens undercover. Oh, yes, yes. To end the show today, I want to have a few thoughts about some sweet things here. We've got a news item from Donna here.
Oh, yeah, we got one little bit of bummer news. There is new research that shows the sugar replacement called erythritol, which is a sugar alcohol, which is actually in a lot of non-caloric sweeteners. Like, it's even added to stevia or monk fruit or the keto diets that people are on, and it's in a lot of diabetic products. Okay, we have recently discovered that the degree that it is linked to heart attacks and strokes. So once again, folks, read your ingredient lists. If you are, a large consumer of these products, I would pull back. The lead study author, Dr. Stanley Hazen, says the degree of risk was not modest. Okay, this is pretty serious. It says people with existing risk factors for heart disease, such as most diabetics who would be eating this product because it's a non-caloric sweetener, were twice as likely to experience heart attack or stroke. So be careful. And do read your ingredients list. And another thing to watch out for, erythritol.
And good job on pronouncing it.
I don't think I even pronounced it right. Erythritol. 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 There we go. That's the one. It is one of the predominant non-caloric sweeteners used. So there's a lot of it out there. Pay attention. Take care of yourselves.
Be careful. Well, and another sweet thing to think about. It is in between winter and spring. It's maple syrup time.
Oh, yes, it is. That's a good sweetener.
The trees are waking up, and the trees will keep the maple trees will be giving us sap when the daytime temperatures just climb above freezing and the nighttime temperatures go below freezing. That's when the magic starts. When you think of all those trees waking up.
And it's a good year this year for the run, apparently.
So, as long as this weather holds. It may not be all that great for us, kind of at freezing, but as long as it's above freezing during the day and below freezing at night, things are moving. Things are good. That's a sweet thing happening. Oh, Donna, tell people about our podcast.
Yes, the Donna Lana Kitchen Show is, in addition to being on the radio, it is in a podcast format. You can find it anywhere you listen to podcasts. Just type in Donna Lana, which is one word, D-O-N-N-A-L-O-N-N-A, second word, kitchen, and you will find us.
Great.
Convenient.
Great. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. We come to you Tuesdays live at noon, repeated at 7 p.m. or any time on this fine community radio station. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had excellent engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.